Welcome back to The Lars Resort, which is still a podcast with me, Lars Sivertsen, still brought to you by Betsson and the resort now. Very much a resort on the road. You can't tell this because it's a podcast. It kind of doesn't matter where I record it, but it is now very much being recorded on a different side of the planet than to where it usually is recorded, which is very exciting for me. What is even more exciting for me, and I hope exciting for you as well, is that our friend of the show, the best friend of the show at this point, I would say, Peter Welpson is with me, but he is not with me through the internet. He is sat next to me, which is pretty crazy given how many times he's been with me through the internet. I have Peter in front of me. He's real. He exists. Here he is, and he is back on the pod. Hello, Peter.
Many thoughts. First off, you are actually real and exist, which is interesting to me. Two, it does feel like we are ruining the illusion of the resort. Because the resort is supposed to be like a vacation spot. But if the resort then goes on vacation.
Yeah, what happens when the vacation goes on vacation?
So it's not really the resort anymore. So it's like Lars vacation.
Yeah, but it's still the resort. Listen, the resort can be mobile. So sometimes the resort goes on the road.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, okay.
I also think anybody listening to this and the image, the theater of the mind over the many episodes is that the resort is some sort of exotic tropical location.
Oh, it is.
Well, you're in Dallas, Texas, which is
tropical to me. It's very warm outside.
No, it's not the same thing, Lars.
No, you picked me up from the airport and it was late at night and I was like, I can't wear a coat here. My coat is too warm. I have to being outside when it's dark and not wearing a coat is incredibly exotic for me.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome to the Texas resort.
Thank you. The Texan resort is what we've turned into. And I'm going to recycle a joke that I made on your radio show, which is it's very exciting. Because from your perspective, when you meet a friend you've had over the internet for a while, you know, when you meet someone you've known over the internet for a while, that friend turning out to be like slightly podgy man with a beard and thinning hair is usually like the worst case scenario. But in this case, it's what we were aiming for.
It's exactly what
we
thought.
And that is what emerged from the plane yesterday.
This is the best Tinder date of all time.
Oh my God. Well, already you go into slightly blue territory, sir.
Why is that blue?
I can't stop you.
Isn't that a dating app?
yes it is. What happens on the best Tinder date of all time, Peter?
You have a nice dinner.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe hold some hands, recite some Bible verses.
You've been married for a very long time, haven't you?
Yes. The idea of online internet dating confounds me to no end, for sure.
Exactly right. Well, this is as much as this could be the Lars and Peter hangout pod. We remain a football podcast, and football has happened. There have been no episodes of the resort since the weekend, and many things happened at the weekend, which I feel like we have to discuss. And actually, I mean, that's part of how our sort of friendship came into being, at least from my side of things. I can't speak to you, but I find it incredibly therapeutic to talk to you about what happened at the weekend. We've been doing that on the Mondays. So let's do a bit of that,
okay.
Even though it is Wednesday.
Hit it.
Okay, well, there was a game at the weekend of some magnitude. Possibly the last iteration of the Klopp v. Guardiola. But I don't believe that.
Yeah,
I
was going to say.
Yeah.
Are we really seriously buying into the idea that Klopp and Guardiola will never manage against each other again, either at the club or international level?
I think they'll meet later this season because I think they'll bump into each other in the FA Cup.
Ah,
both
okay.
these teams are still in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
And
does that count anymore?
Yeah, of course it counts.
Okay.
No, listen, well, the cups count when you get far. If you go out early, like, it doesn't matter. We can focus on the league. If you get far, it's a trophy and it's important.
Okay.
It's turned into the League
yes,
Cup.
Yes, of course, it'll
the
count.
League Cup, I think, even more so than the FA Cup. But the League Cup is like the Room of Requirement from Harry Potter. It is what you want it to be. Like, if you go out early, you can say, well, it doesn't matter.
Right.
If you go really far, it's like, this is great. Winning mentality and wins a trophy. It's amazing. So it is exactly what you want it to be, the Cups. I think they'll bump into each other in the Cup. But it was certainly the last Premier League encounter. And this might be a bit trite, and it's been said already, but I just want to take a moment to just note how enjoyable this rivalry has been, because the games are almost always fun. And that's not always true with these sort of top-of-the-table, cataclysmic, sort of this-is-important clashes, they can sometimes be a bit dour and a bit cagey. But Klopp's Liverpool versus Pep's Man City has been a consistently fun thing to watch, because I think that is because Klopp, more than anyone, goes out to try to disrupt City. They don't sit back. They believe that, we've spoken about it on the resort before, Klopp believes very strongly that the only way you can get at City is by disrupting them and not letting them fall into their pattern. And that means taking risks, it means opening up a little bit, but it does mean we often get a lot of fun games. And I thought this was fun. This was a lot of fun.
Well, when you were kind enough to sit in on my radio show last weekend, I bravely, I would suggest, bravely predicted a draw.
Mm.
But I also predicted that it would be a thrilling game. Now, that all probably is pretty rudimentary and obvious, but I was still proud of it because it was. I mean, if you ever needed a perfect example of how a draw could be an exciting game at the same time, this was it. It was fun. It was fantastic. There was drama. There was lots of talking points, things to, you know, controversies. And we even got the moment of Erling Haaland versus Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah.
And the great, like a scene, a boss scene out of a movie or something.
yeah, we did. And yeah, a bit of a quiet one from Erling Haaland. But then again, he often has quiet ones. It's either scores or he doesn't do an awful lot. That seems to be the way. And he didn't score on this particular occasion. I thought it was an interesting case of a game of two halves. I thought both teams had one half of the game in which they were able to do roughly what they wanted, because in the first half, City had a pretty good degree of control. The tempo of the game wasn't super high. I thought the pattern of the game in the first half was like, this is how City want a game at Anfield to go. But then Liverpool, after halftime, kind of came out and were more successful at disrupting City and getting those dangerous counter-attacking moments. Luis Diaz, should have scored, of course. And he was very good in general at disrupting City stuff. And I thought it was interesting that Guardiola felt moved to take off Kevin De Bruyne after about 70 minutes, because I read that as him wanting more control over the game, because De Bruyne, again, is the guy who plays the more high-risk passes and stuff, and I think taking him off and putting Kovacic on is a sort of, let's settle this down, let's keep the ball some more, and let's get control back over the game. I thought that was what that was all about. But Liverpool did better in the second half than I thought they would. The first half is how I thought this game was going to go, basically. I predicted, I had in the betting column, I had City to get something. I had both teams to score and Liverpool to not win was basically my pick. And that one of few things that landed this week, to the weekend, slightly cursed weekend for the betting column, but that this one landed. But what I did not think was that Liverpool had that second half in them, because they kind of deserved to win, I thought, with the way they managed to run at City and make things happen after the break.
It felt like to me, just watching it on television, that the power of Anfield was really benefiting Liverpool in this. Mm. And the one thing that I really admired about Liverpool out of this match was City is famous for having so many different ways to beat you.
Mm.
And so if you go the route of cutting Haaland out of the game by eliminating passing to him, well, then they're going to get you some other way with somebody on the wing. But Liverpool was so good at disrupting all of that for City and really frustrating them. When they got to the second half, to me, it felt like Pep went into sort of a different mode overall for City, where they almost were like, okay, let's just, to your point, let's control this game and not force the issue. And that, to me, I think is a really unique view of City that we very rarely see, where Pep feels threatened.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, Luis Diaz should have scored, but then again, Doku was off the post, and you know, some other things that happened. So it was a very, very even game on the whole, but so much to talk about tactics and how these two guys go at each other and what they both did well and maybe not as well in these particular games, which I find fascinating, because we so rarely get to see these two teams both display their strengths and also get a little bit exposed in areas.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I thought, when I was sort of trying to preview this game, I thought this was a hard game to preview because both teams are just really good. There's not a ton of weaknesses. But the thing that made me think that City would get something was that I kind of don't trust this Liverpool midfield yet. It's still so much of a work in progress. And the game I referenced was when they went away to Arsenal to the Emirates, when they had like Govan, Beck, McAllister and Jones in midfield, and Arsenal just kind of steamrolled them a little bit and they couldn't get a foothold in that game. But of course, this was a different Liverpool midfield. This was Szoboszlai, Endo and McAllister. And that is a very... I've always thought... this is their strongest midfield three when everyone's fit. I've always been pretty clear in my mind that Endo as the water carrier and then freeing up McAllister to be more of an attacking force and then Szoboszlai as a sort of roaming number eight, that is what that midfield should look like when everyone's fit. And I thought they stood up much better to City than I thought they maybe would be able to do.
I think you're burying the lead.
Hmm?
Because one, Salah didn't start, so that's a big miss. Mm. But now let's go to the backside of Liverpool.
Yeah.
They essentially only have one of their five defensive players playing either as a starter and also playing their natural position.
Yeah,
they don't have their starting keeper, who, by the way, I want to comment about Kelleher real quick.
Mm.
He's been outstanding.
Yeah, he needs to move in the summer, doesn't he?
And my observation about him is that he looks like every random white guy with a beard... police sketch drawing.
Police sketch?
Yes.
What kind of crime do you think Kelleher has committed?
Probably some sort of financial crime.
Some sort of wire fraud.
Yeah, wire fraud or embezzlement or something.
He sold some people some crypto that didn't exist.
I just want everybody listening to ponder on that. And next time you see a close-up or a shot of Kelleher, go and think about every police sketch
looks like
you've
a
ever
police
seen.
Sketch.
And he's got that face. It looks like somebody sketched it on his head. Anyway, You got Gomez playing out on the left.
Yeah.
You got this kid playing center back.
Yeah, Kwanzaa, yeah.
And another kid playing right
Connor
back.
Bradley.
And so to be able to put that lineup out there and get the result they got, I think is a huge testament to Klopp. And it also makes you wonder what the result would have been had Liverpool been at full strength.
So it's an interesting one in which, looking just at the lineups and the personnel available, for all the reasons you just mentioned, maybe City will look at that and feel like this was an opportunity missed, because with Liverpool that weakened, they should be able to go and get the win. But then the way the game went, I think Liverpool will look at the second half and think like, we should have gotten something here. But then you're absolutely right. In the midst of all of that, Doku hits the post. And Phil Foden has that weird sort of ball that gets punched into his face and then comes off the bar.
That would have been the worst way to lose a game.
Yeah. Are we given that? By the way, given that this podcast leans heavily on like obscure Star Wars references, I'm upset that no one has started calling Jeremy Dooku Count Dooku yet. I mean, why is this not happening?
Well, that's probably up to you to start.
Yeah, we have to. Yeah, should we just? Yeah, though, of course, Jeremy Dooku does not look much like Christopher Lee. I mean, physically, they're not entirely similar.
Well, you've already thrown an outstanding Harry Potter reference in, so
yeah,
I don't know if you need an additional
sort of
Star Wars reference. I think you've got it.
There's never enough additional Star Wars references.
You've got that
covered.
We can
only have more of them. Lastly, I guess brief mention on the baby boy, Erling Haaland, who I need to stop calling the baby boy. That doesn't even make sense. But he had not a ton of chances in this game. He did have that one opportunity when he got to run at Virgil van Dijk.
Man, that was such an outstanding moment. I remember sitting on my sofa watching this moment, and when it was very clear that was about to happen, I literally stood up and watched like I was at the stadium.
Yeah.
Because the idea that we were going to get to see the league's arguably best center back and the best striker literally on a clear run from midfield into goal, and how that was going to play out.
Yeah.
I mean, we've dreamt about seeing that.
Yeah, and you have to credit Virgil van Dijk. I think he handled it beautifully, the way he positioned his body. And
okay, hold on. Who won that battle?
Well, Haaland did get a shot off, but he wasn't completely in balance, and it wasn't, you know...
Think his failure to score is up to van Dijk? And
well,
how Van Dijk
well,
played
Van
the
Dijk
moment?
Sort of shepherds him into an area where he has to take a shot not in a great position and not with his body fully in balance. So Van Dijk successfully, I mean, he does get a finish off as a center half. Maybe you feel like you haven't done your job if the guy gets a shot off. But he gets a shot off under suboptimal circumstances. And I kind of think, I mean, it's hard to pick holes in a guy with Erling Haaland's scoring record. but he still favors his left foot to a degree that makes him a little bit predictable in those situations. Because when Haaland squares up and runs at Van Dijk there, and he has a lot of space to work with, but Van Dijk is a fast guy.
Half the field, yeah.
But Van Dijk is a quick guy as well. Van Dijk knows Haaland wants this on his left foot. He knows that everything Haaland does in the next couple of seconds is going to be geared towards getting a shot off with his left foot.
So why did he let him go to his left?
There's 0% chance that he's going to go to the right. But I think that helps Van Dijk because he can position his body accordingly. You know, he actually switches side once, but you can see from the way he's running, he always knows Haaland is going to go on this side of me.
Yeah.
And I do wonder sometimes if Haaland, just for the sake of variation, if he'd tried to hit people on the other side. Because he doesn't trust his right foot as much, it makes the finish a lot harder, but it makes him harder to read if he mixes that up a little bit. Because I think in those situations, the defenders do kind of know what he wants to do. And I think, and again, Haaland is his own biggest critic. He always says this in interviews, you know, I can get better at everything. And for a guy who's completely obsessed with improving, I'm sure he's aware of this already. But that trusting his right foot a little bit more and going to that side of the field a little bit more often so that you put a bit more doubt in the minds of the defenders, I think that's something that maybe he should do.
I'm
going to
submit that Virgil van Dijk feels like he got off lucky.
Yeah.
Because I read that as Erling got the little bit better of him because he did get the ball and ultimately on his left foot.
Yeah.
And I don't now that it's been a few days, I don't remember exactly where the shot went and how difficult the save was for Kelleher.
Not very difficult.
So it's probably a wash all the way around.
So, and there is a broader Erling Haaland discussion to be had because, I mean, even though he has scored a lot of goals this season.
No, you're going to do this, aren't you?
We're not going to do the full. I'm just going to very briefly because he isn't overperforming his XG this season, which is the big difference. Like he's always been the sort of otherworldly finisher,
right?
Who scores more goals than his numbers suggests he should. He famously gets into a ton of chances. I know it's been Michael Owen who suggested that he's not actually a great finisher because he misses quite a few chances. Now that sounds like a ludicrous thing to say about a guy with his scoring record. I mean, I would say it's possible. You can make the case that he might not be a natural finisher. Like he's someone who's had to work on his finishing and improve it. And he's
there's a world of YouTube videos out there where he's just a little squirrel banging goals.
Yeah, for sure. But it's also like, I think Solskjaer has said something similar actually about how like he has to work on the training ground to work on this. Because there's some like Michael Owen is someone who just had a knack. Like if he had the ball in the box, he would find a way to get a clean strike off. And on target. If you compare him to someone like Michael Owen, compare him to someone like Sergio Aguero, for instance, had an incredible gift for getting a clean strike off in any kind of space and angle in the box. Haaland can be weirdly clumsy at times. And when he had that extraordinary miss the other week
against United,
people were like, oh my God, I can't believe he's missed this. And like, I can believe he's missed this because he does do that occasionally.
You know, it's funny. If you compare and contrast the Premier League careers of Erling Haaland and Darwin Nunez, it's almost as if they're kind of the opposite of each other because Haaland got in the league and immediately started hitting goal after goal after goal and could not miss. Mm. And has, in his second season, tailed off a little bit. Nunez is the opposite, where he showed up and couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Mm.
And now, more times than he was in his first season, is hitting some real special goals.
Yeah, no, and can I also just add a twist to that? Amusingly, the first game Haaland played in England was the Community Shield game against Liverpool, where Darwin scored and Haaland had a really bad miss.
Right.
So it actually started being the opposite. But then Haaland scored against West Ham in the first game, so then he was up and running. But my point is that it's one of the reasons I find him so compelling as a player is that he is someone who's obviously incredibly powerful and fast.
And he's awkward around girls.
And well, you know, well, he was. I mean, I'm not sure if he is anymore, but he certainly was back in the day when we've all seen the stretching video that Dortmund made. It's just because stretching is good, you should stretch. And
it's
this
the greatest
is a good way
video
to learn.
Of all time.
It's amazing. But he's also capable of a very graceful and physically impressive. Like you've seen the YouTube videos of all his goals, but he also has moments where he looks just inexplicably clumsy for someone who is a world class athlete. Yeah. I think that makes him fallible in a way that I find fascinating and engaging. But what I'm getting to at a roundabout way is that in his last three seasons, he outperformed his XG. which if you consistently outperform your XG, it usually means you're a good finisher. If you're someone who regularly don't outperform your XG and then you have one season when you suddenly do, you're probably on a hot streak and you're probably going to regress. With Haaland, he has been outperforming his XG in the past. Now he's pretty much on his XG, which is why it feels like he's missed a lot of chances, because he's missed some chances. Mm-hmm. I think this season is the exception, put it that way. I think he's in a little bit of a funk. He's been a little bit frustrated.
Has maybe this season the quality of those chances decreased because teams in the Premier League are, you know, in theory the best league in the world, has figured out ways to kind of minimize him?
Maybe, but then I feel like this could be like recency bias, but I watched pretty much all his games last year as well, I think. I think if you make like a compilation of his worst misses from this season, it would look worse than the compilation from last season.
Oh, I think 100%.
He's missed more big chances this year.
Yeah, I agree. He's missed more headers, yeah. And then obviously the big. I think I swear somewhere somebody reported that the chance that he missed against United was a 0.9.
Yeah,
on
one
the
of
XG.
These. XG. Yeah. Yeah.
Like essentially, it was harder not to score than.
And
to
he's
score.
Not a subtle guy. Like he doesn't. Pep has brought this up. Like his body. Pep wants him to improve his body language, but he doesn't hide when he's frustrated and when he's upset, and we've seen him play like with a bit of a face on and look a bit annoyed a lot this season, and I should stress he's not annoyed with his teammates, he's annoyed with himself when he's like that. And
well, that's why I thought that moment between him and Van Dijk was such a pinnacle moment. It's something that I think we've all been waiting to see mm-hmm. happen ever since he got into the league. And it was a weird kind of disappointing result. Not that he didn't score, but the fact that it wasn't the result. It didn't end in the one of the two ways I think you would want it to result. You would want it to result either A, in Alan scoring a great goal and beating Van Dijk in scoring, mm-hmm. or B, Van Dijk just tackling the ball yeah. and running away from Haaland, leaving him on the pitch.
No, I thought Van Dijk played it smart. He just kind of shepherded him and he got a shot off, but not in a yeah. ball. And I mean, it wasn't like with Branthwaite when he just ran him over. Like, that's not... that didn't happen. But that's the danger with trying to tackle him or getting yeah. too physical with him. He'll just bounce off. But anyway... What a fun game. What an interesting game. And I guess a draw is a good result. And I still think these two teams will meet again. I think they'll bump into each other in the FA Cup final.
And the best part is that it completely just added to the idea that we're actually going to have a race to the end of the season. Because after all, at the end of all of it, Arsenal ended up on top of the table at the end of the weekend.
They did. Top of the table, Arsenal. And what a few days for Arsenal this was. Not fully last minute, but late winner against Brentford. In a game that I thought was really interesting, because last season their defensive numbers kind of collapsed halfway through the season. We've talked about this a lot, so like quality wise there was a problem, but I also just thought there was a lot of emotion in that team. They seemed to like overreact to events, and this was a game that really tested them. Like, it wasn't pretty, but Brentford, with a lot of injuries, it's difficult times for Brentford right now. Because they got that weird goal through Aaron Ramsdale having a significant brain fart, Brentford then went into full like spoiling mode, like time wasting and doing really annoying things. And it's been so funny because Brentford had played City recently, they played Tottenham recently, and now they played Arsenal. So I've had like three separate fan groups all up in my like in my Twitter feed going, oh my god, Brentford are the most annoying team ever, because they're very good at like time wasting and just being annoying. And that was before Neil Mopai was substituted on. And this sort of thing, Arsenal are still, we forget this, they're still a pretty young squad. And I feel like the Arsenal in the past might have gotten annoyed with the pressure of knowing they need the 3 points, with Brentford wasting time and trying to pick fights and being annoying. I wonder if, like, last year, Arsenal would have let that occasion and that frustration get to them, whereas I thought they did a pretty good job staying calm here. And of course there were some flare-ups, but they kept playing and they kept chugging away, and they got the goal in the end. And I, even though that game, they didn't blow Brentford away in the way they have a few other teams recently, I kind of think that's a more impressive win than scoring like 100 goals against Sheffield United, because, you know, I thought that was really well handled. Another good moment for us Kai Havertz truthers.
He did it for the second time this season.
Yeah.
late goal against Brentford to get the win.
Yeah, love Kai. I like Kai up front. There are upsides and downsides, but he's a very good player, and I think that position seems to work for now.
Look, we've spent, how much time have you and I spent wherever talking about concerning or worrying over the fact that Arteta seemed to be trying to force a square peg in a round hole? And it turns out that, you know, just give him some time to let him gel with everybody else, and it's worked out. By and large, he's been a really good addition to the squad.
Yeah, but I think it is funny. I'm pretty sure Arteta even said this on the record, that he wanted him to be a number eight, a midfielder, because he had the skill set to be a pretty complete midfielder. And then he did that, and then it just didn't quite work. And we've seen several examples now of that midfield just being better with Jorginho in there to stabilize things, freeing up Declan Rice a little bit, freeing up Ødegaard totally. That leaves Kai Havertz playing up front again, which is what he seemed a bit dissatisfied with having to do at Chelsea. But it's working. It's not.
Look, they've been on a tremendous run of late. They have scored an absolute 55-gallon drum worth of goals in the last few weeks, and they've all done it while we're still sitting around, you know, possibly debating whether or not they need a true striker or not. And it's like, why? They don't. I mean, they're doing this without a couple of players. They're scoring a lot of goals. If you were to think about the race to the, you know, for the Premier League, it's pretty clear to me that Arsenal's in the best form of the three teams.
Yeah, and unlike last season, because again, last season there was a period when they were getting some late winners and the momentum was still there in terms of points, but like the underlying numbers had already collapsed.
Yeah.
And I'm still annoyed with myself for not picking that up. The difference is this season that hasn't happened. Like, their numbers are looking very strong. They're earning these wins. And I said this on the resort a couple of weeks ago. If you look at the betting markets, the City were still clear favourites to win the league, followed by Liverpool, and then there was a gap down to Arsenal, and I didn't agree with this. I honestly think there's not a big, like, I think Arsenal are as likely to win the league as Liverpool, if it's not going to be City. And now that gap has closed completely since then. I mean, we're looking at the prices with bets on now. City are still favourites at a price of 220, followed then by Liverpool at 325, followed again by Arsenal at 350. Now, I kind of jokingly said a couple of weeks ago, Arsenal were as far out as 7 or 750, and I said, well, if you really think Arsenal can do it, you should get on there. Turns out that was, that odds has now shortened dramatically.
Does that feel correct to you?
That Arsenal are still the third favorite with the...
Well, no, just the numbers overall. City's value, Liverpool's value, and Arsenal's value. Whether, you know, their tightness of it is obviously, I think, correct.
Yeah.
But is the order correct?
Well, City are still... It's still this sort of historic... I think what's baked into the City prize is the history, really. Just the idea that Pep will find a way, and that we're only seeing this team really start to come together now, and that there's still more to come from them, I think, is why City are favourites. And there's a bit of people, and I got to admit, even me, just looking at City being better than evens, it's kind of tempted to jump on, to be honest, because I still think deep down that City will find a way, and then that it's very close between Arsenal and Liverpool. That seems about right. But I didn't think it was right a couple of weeks ago, where Liverpool were much shorter than Arsenal. I think that I thought that they should have been closer, and that's what they've ended up being now.
Yeah, it's going to come down to the end of the month when Arsenal has to go to City and play that game, that next game for both those teams, and that, this probably seems captain obvious, but if Arsenal can get anything out of that, I think their path to achieving something this season is much more clear.
Yeah, and here was what I was saying. I missed the Porto game because I was in transit, so I didn't see that.
But that was interesting.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
Well, because Porto just did this I think this is something everybody is talking about right now, which is how does a Portuguese team, you know, stretch Arsenal all the way. Everybody's talking about, you know, salary differences and the cost of the teams and all that stuff. But Porto just did such a masterful job of playing a mid block and really played so well and organized. And he's always been the villain I love to hate more than anybody else in football.
Pepe was doing Pepe things.
Well, no, but here's the deal. He's closer in my age than he is, you know, most of the Arsenal team, and he was all over the place last night.
Well, that's actually true. Yeah,
I was making a joke, but
it's
you're right.
Not an exaggeration. I think that's actually true.
And Arsenal just couldn't figure out how to break it. They couldn't screw together getting in behind. They couldn't figure out a way to pass through it. They couldn't figure out a way to go around it. And it took a real top quality moment. I mean, the peak Arsenal passing for them to finally get the goal they needed to tie the game. And, you know, Raya did what he needed to do in penalty kicks and blah, blah, blah. But they were very, very much stretched against Porto. And I do think it is the ingredients for other teams to figure out if they can even play a semblance of the organization and commitment that Porto did last night, you know, give people a chance to try to do something against Arsenal.
Huh. Well, again, I wasn't able to watch the game, so I can't really comment, but I would add as a context that that's kind of what you're describing is a little bit typical of Porto, because within Portugal, there is like a football and cultural difference between the north and the south of the country.
Oh, okay.
So Porto being from the second city further to the north, it's a city that has a bit more of a gruff working class vibe anyway.
You're listening to Lars Football Social Studies brought to you by Betson.
And historically, the football in the north of Portugal is a little bit more physical, battly, scrappy, whereas sort of Benfica and Sporting is a little bit more showboaty, sort of swashbuckly type of thing. And we often see this reflected in Europe, where Porto, while often being a less sort of charming and interesting team than the Benfica versions or some of the best Sporting teams, they tend to do a bit better in the Champions League because they are better set up. They have this sort of the scrappy backbone to them. I mean, when they won it under Mourinho, that was the apex of this, right? Because that was a very niggly team that cheated a lot and were unpleasant to play against. But Porto seem to be more set up to punch up in Europe than Benfica and Sporting are.
You know how it's very popular these days on social media for tactical breakdown sites, Twitter accounts, whatever, to do screen grabs and draw graphics to kind of show you the outline of how a team is set up.
Yeah.
Porto looked like a screen grab the entire night.
Mm.
You could just so clearly see their definition and how they were set up to really frustrate Arsenal. It was super impressive. I'm not that I follow the Portuguese league at all, but you would think that Arsenal went into this thinking they got the best of all the Champions League draws.
Yeah.
Or got a good one, or one of the better, easier ones, quote unquote. And I think that turned out to be really way more than they were bargaining for.
Yeah, they're just never pleasant to play against. And actually, I just very quickly looked this up, underscoring that domestically, like, Porto are third behind Sporting and Benfica. And Porto have scored 46 goals this season, Sporting have scored 69. So there's like a huge, in terms of offensive output. You know, both and Benfica have scored 59. So both Benfica and Sporting have so much more going for them in an attacking sense domestically. But Porto have this sort of scrappy thing. And that they made it really difficult for Arsenal, obviously, over the two legs. And I would say, just reflecting back to the title discussion, there's a fine balance here, because getting last minute winners and stuff like this, sometimes you have to ask yourself, well, why do you need to get them? But occasionally getting them, I think, can be good psychologically, because it gives everyone a boost and it gives belief that even when things are hard, we can get it done in the end. So I think this was a really positive, aside from getting the points and progressing, I think the way it happened the last few days is a big boost for Arsenal.
Yes, and it certainly feels like that Arteta has improved in how he manages this team and gets results out of them after going through a significant run of what appeared to be just the easiest peasiest of matches and winning 5-1, 4, whatever it was, and then having to kind of grind out a result against Brentford over the weekend and really suffer and grind out against Porto. I'm sure Arsenal fans are very tense about that or concerned. I would argue, to your point, and that's actually a good lesson for them.
Yeah.
And a good experience.
And maybe they go to the Etihad and lose 5-0 and all this sounds silly, but I just don't think this is a group that'll do that. I don't buy it. I don't think so.
My question for you, will the Arsenal City game be more entertaining or less entertaining than Liverpool City?
Oh, I think less. I think quite a lot less.
You do?
Because Arsenal, I mean, Arsenal, yeah, they've been spanking these smaller teams, but one of the reasons why Arsenal have been doing so much better this season is that they're playing in a more controlled manner. Mm. Now, what happens when that comes up against City? I'm not quite sure, but I think that game could be quite drab. Hope I'm jinxing this and hope I'm totally wrong, but I think there's a chance that it isn't, but it should be fascinating. As a side note,
can I just say real quick, this is kind of a weird experience doing this with you literally 2 feet away.
Yeah.
This is very...
Because it's usually like several thousand miles away.
Right. And watching you talk and scan the computer at the same time is just
fascinating. Don't tell them. They think I have all this stuff in my head constantly. Oh, but no, I'm sort of, yeah.
Am I ruining the illusion?
Yeah, you pay no attention to the man behind the thing. Okay. The Oz the Great and Powerful. No, I do this. I sort of simultaneously look up.
Well, that's how we all do it.
But it also comes from like... I have a morbid fear of saying and publishing things that are not correct, like having factual errors.
Oh, man.
No, honestly, I literally lose sleep if I say stuff on the radio that turns out I've misremembered something or whatever.
Clearly.
That will actually keep me up at night.
That's never been my issue.
So frequently, I will, like, if I know I'm going to mention a result from the past or a lineup or something, I will often know it, but I want to double check it before I say it out loud. So a lot
That's
of this, what you're seeing me
you
going
Lars.
Through things, I'm just looking up things to double check is what's happening often. On a more flippant note, at what point does Ben White's skin color just kind of become a form of cultural appropriation? Like, this is... He's turning Hispanic before our very eyes. Like, this is...
He's kind of like English football's Donald Trump.
Yeah, what is that? Does this guy have, like, one of... He has one of those spray tan things at
home. And I don't mean politically.
Home.
I just mean...
Well, I hope not. I mean,
fashion or skincare choice.
Yeah.
He clearly just likes to be... tan or orange or some, you know, that's his deal. And
I'm almost certain
too much time on his hands.
I've seen Arsenal fans call him Benny Blanco, and I think this is why the increasingly Hispanic Ben White.
Hey, look, at the end of the Brentford game, his deft cross,
so good
for the winner, was, I don't think, has gotten enough credit.
No, absolutely not.
It was if you've ever gotten an opportunity to try to cross a ball in like that, to be able to do that in the waning moments of a game and hit it so perfectly and so with such an artisan touch, I don't care if he decides he wants to tint his skin purple, whatever.
For a guy who started out as a center half as well, he's pretty incredible.
Yes, but the spray tan is very weird, and I guess it's his version of like a bunch of tattoos.
Yeah, yeah. Instead, yeah, yeah. Benny Blanco. Let's make it a thing. And
can
I think,
you imagine the ring color at the bottom of his shower? After, like how often?
I'm sure
clean
he has
that
people
thing?
To clean it. He's a very wealthy man.
Oh, okay.
I'm just going to... This is me, again, live double-checking something. Because he's a centre-half, but I'm pretty sure he played a lot of... a good amount of defence. He's played quite a lot of... he's played some games in defensive midfield as well. He played some games as a defensive midfielder under Bielsa, actually, I think, for Leeds, when he went on loan there, if I recall correctly, and for Brighton as well. So he's always been, like, a ball-playing dude. But, no, he's really quite extraordinary as a...
Is the
as
tanning,
a right-back.
Does the tanning solution make him slippery like Adam Traore?
Is he very? Yeah, maybe that should be, because,
or if maybe it's like an off-putting chemical smell.
Maybe I need to ask. So we need to ask Jonas Bergjonsson, the sort of reporter for Norwegian TV who interviews people. Who's I don't know if you've seen it, but a couple of the sort of viral clips of Ben White being slightly rude to a reporter, like two of those have been with.
Well, probably because everybody just wants to ask him about why he's tanning so much.
Yeah, well, I don't think he has. I think he's been very angry. But I think we need to ask Jonas. Maybe we should actually have him on the pod. We should ask Jonas. Ben White, next time you're interviewing him, try to touch his skin and ask sort of,
is he
Ben,
hot to
are
the
you
touch?
Yeah, are you very slippery? I think that'd be
strong
very popular.
Odor of rosewood.
That would go down really well, I think. Please, Benny Blanco,
do not
let me touch
the Arsenal defender.
Let me touch your face. That's what you want from an interviewer in the mix
zone. Do the curtains
zone.
Match the drapes?
Jesus. Okay, moving on.
This
what
is
are we
fun.
Moving on to?
This is way fun.
Your guys, Man United. You
no,
did the Man United
please.
Thing again.
No.
Okay, we can just say it. We've said it before. They won another game without playing very well.
They are winning games while simultaneously looking about as crappy as I've ever seen a Manchester United. This is arguably the worst season and Manchester United that I can think of in a very, very long time. In terms of all the stats.
Is it even worse than like the sort of Solskjaer-Ragnik misadventure?
I would argue during Solskjaer, I actually knew what they were doing.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Ragnik was just too short of a run and it was already so broken at that point. My favorite part are all the headlines that are coming out these days about how Ineos now is potentially going to follow Ragnik's original
plan,
reconstruction plan.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I'm sure. He's in sort of big picture thinking. Ragnik is clearly a very sharp guy.
Yeah.
Whether he was suitable as a caretaker, I think we've had this discussion.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. The whole as a fan, it's extremely frustrating to watch. I've kind of resolved to whatever happens. I have no expectations for them to make a run for a top four spot or even a top five spot.
Here's the thing, though. They might.
No, they're not.
They might.
Stop.
They're on 47 points. They're just 6 points behind Tottenham. They're just 8 points behind Villa. And I don't trust. I mean, we can segue into that. We don't need to say more about United, I think, at this point, because it's more of the same. But I don't trust Villa or Spurs to not have a slump between now and the end of the season.
Okay.
I think it's entirely possible.
But why would you not include the odds of United having a slump between now and then is even greater. United still have to go away to Chelsea, home to Liverpool. They've got a home game against Newcastle and a home game against Arsenal. And then away, they end the season at Brighton.
Yeah.
They have a significantly more difficult schedule than Tottenham or Villa.
They do. And I just think there's something about their ability to get eke points out of games in which they play terrible football that seems to be... I don't feel comfortable writing. It's because they have like good individuals. But then again, they're like... Just looking at the table now, they've scored 39 goals. They've scored one goal more than Luton. Like, this seems bad.
Well, look, the big talking point and the thing that you and I talked about on the radio show the other day was this confusing point of view that Erik ten Hag has about how many shots they've allowed in the last six. Literally 143 shots.
Yeah.
And somebody at The Athletic wrote an article today about that and trying to make the case that maybe the fact that United has allowed all these shots isn't as bad a sign as you think it would. But at the end of the day, to use an overused cliche phrase, when you are at the bottom of a table of shots allowed with Sheffield United and Luton on how many shots per game, that's not a good sign.
No.
That's never a good health indicator for the status of your situation.
And I just think one of my favorite sort of big picture
Luton and the Blades.
One of my favorite sort of big picture metrics, certainly at this point in the season, because the sample size is like 28 games, so it's quite a lot, is to look at your XG goal difference per 90. You know, your simple case of the XG you've produced minus what you've conceded. And in there, United are just in the sort of lower reach of the just below mid-table, sandwiched in between Bournemouth and Palace. That's not where you want
to
be.
You don't have to have a coaching license. You don't have to be a hardcore tactical nerd to watch United play and go, this thing is very discombobulated.
Yeah.
And they're always open. There's always some, they don't press together very well. They don't cover midfield very well together. And as much as I hate to say it, because as I've said to you many times, I really want him to be the guy. It all feels like it's how Ten Hag is setting the team up. Maybe because he feels that way, he has to do it because of the limited number of players he has. I don't know, but it's not fun to watch. And two, it's not getting them anywhere in terms of being successful.
No, I concur. And I've said it before. It's this weird thing of having your forward line press quite aggressively, but not keeping a high line with your defense. So you have massive
the
distances.
Space is
huge
ridiculous.
Spaces. And then the guy who's meant to cover all that is Casemiro, who is no longer very fast. And poor Kobbie Mainoo, who's a child.
Well, that's
it just isn't like, yeah.
Well, and that's why I think everybody who thinks about this stuff goes, well, then if you're going to do that, why not put Kobbie towards the back. Let him play the deep lying person and do all the groundwork. And it, and then of course the argument is, well, Casemiro's the one that actually can play those balls and distribute better. And I'm not sure that's the that's true anymore, because he keeps turning the ball over.
No.
Like, watching Casemiro turn the ball over with such ease is such a weird thing to see for a player of his reputation and experience level.
Yeah, I will say though, I have a soft spot for Casemiro, because he just increasingly looks like the Premier League footballer who is the most likely to go along and enjoy the sort of schedule of food that you have ready for us this week. I understand we're going to
eat. I thought you were going to say the character that most looks like a Japanese cartoon character in the face. He has kind of that.
That has never occurred to me, but he just looks like a man who loves a steakhouse.
Yeah.
They're very veiny, a lot of the footballers. They're very skinny, whereas Casemiro...
He is kind of the opposite of Garnacho.
There's a bit of meat on the bone there. There's a man who knows his way around the churrascaria.
Garnacho's semi-close, way too close to Skeletor in his makeup.
Definitely.
Versus Casemiro, yes.
And that was a way for me, realizing the time has ticked along, pivoting back to our plans for the week.
Oh, yes.
It was me signaling that I think the football chat is at an end for
now. Is that all we're going to do?
I think so, because we're 40 minutes and something in. And
I'm about to take you for your first Texas barbecue experience.
Oh my good lord, like this is tremendous. It's also I've been dieting a lot over the last sort of 6-7 months. I feel a lot of good work is about to get undone, but I am massively here for it, and I'll go back to dieting when I leave the state of Texas.
So just to pull the curtain back, last night Lars arrived at our airport at a kind of mid-evening time, and I said to him, "Are you hungry?" And he's like, "Yeah, I haven't had anything to eat." Your trip was, what, 26 hours?
Yeah, something like that.
Because of all the different flight combobulations. Yeah. And poor guy, you got so screwed on your itinerary.
I was.
Which should have been a simple 10-hour flight. Ended up taking you all day to get here. Literally an entire revolution of the earth.
Yep.
And you got here and you were hungry. And I took you to a local little a burger shop.
Mm.
And watching you consume that burger, you look like you were a prisoner that had been let out of prison. And so I'm eager.
You've rarely seen a burger that fast disappear, that big disappear.
And that wasn't
this
a
quickly.
Small, that wasn't like a
no,
McDonald's
that was,
burger. That was
that,
like
that
a
was,
legit
yeah.
Jake's burger.
I needed fuel.
Well, we're about to present you Texas brisket.
Oh.
Texas sausage.
Oh.
Pork ribs.
This is exciting.
And whatever various amount of sides you'd like, sir.
This is going to be tremendous. You know what? I mean, maybe I should listen. I don't want to do this now because it's too much like work. But like, do you think I could make it as like a travel YouTuber where I like travel and I film things I eat and then I make a face to the camera? I don't see.
I hope you're not offended by this, but only if you pretend to be and do it under the guise of being Haley Joel Osment, because that'd be the draw, right?
Really?
Yeah, you could be like...
The man who looks mysteriously like current-day Haley Joel Osment eats food.
Yeah.
Okay, I've heard worse concepts for a YouTube channel.
I keep bringing that up, and I can't tell if Lars is annoyed by the fact that I keep making that joke.
It's fine.
I totally regret last night at the airport. I didn't take a selfie of the two of us that I could post on internet. Look, I met Haley Joel Osment at the airport randomly.
No, it's fine. I'll take it. I've been called worse.
Just so you know, when I said to my wife after you went back upstairs, I said, "Doesn't he look like?" She was like, "No, he really doesn't." Like, oh, you don't see it. She's just too kind.
Okay, please, listeners, write in. Who else do I look like?
You look like a character from Game of Thrones that I'm having a hard time coming up with.
Like one of the random extras from the battle scenes of the North.
No, it's one of the kind of shady hands or underlings or whatever.
Okay.
Can't remember which one.
Well, please help Peter out with that one. Everyone write out which Game of Thrones, write in which Game of Thrones character do I look like. No betting segment at the end. We did already talk a little bit about the run-in prices. Probably no betting column this week because of my travels and things. Maybe, but I think we'll probably sneak in another episode later in the week. We'll see what we do. As you haven't heard the last of the sort of roadshow version of the Lars Resort.
Live from live Texas from Resort. Texas.
We might need an update on my food consumption situation and whether I'm still alive a couple of days from now.
I'm taking him also to have Tex-Mex, and I can't quite tell if he's looking forward to that.
I haven't been eating a lot of red meat the last couple of months, so I think these next days will be an interesting...
Well, Tex-Mex isn't a lot of red meat.
That's true.
It's beans and cheese.
It's more the steakhouse situation that could be interesting.
Yeah, we're going to take you to a fine steakhouse, Andy and I.
All right. I'll... should be good. Should be good. I don't do enough with the Facebook. But there is a Lars Resort Facebook group, which you should all join, except for what I'm about to say. There's not that much activity in there. Maybe I could put photos and things.
I'm going to end it with this. I'm just going to speak directly to those listening to the resort that are regulars to the resort. And because this is the first time that I've ever, as we said at the beginning, had an opportunity to meet and spend time with Lars in person. He is exactly as you imagine.
Okay.
And I mean that in the most positive, warm way.
That's very kind of you. And I think that kind of, that sort of warmth and kindness is very much what Peter brings to the table as well. Well, everything's going well in Texas so far.
Along with Tinder references.
Of course. Yeah, Texas Tinder, that's the thing to me. I'm almost tempted to install it now.
No,
just to see what the...
he will not be using my house for a Tinder date.
No, well, no, for a lot of reasons. But yeah, okay, let's end it there. Thanks, everyone. Bye.